Greetings, Mr. and Mrs. Middle America and all the ships at sea. This is Ian Bonnet on Coast to Coast AM. And to the hostile invading alien armies hovering silently behind their cloaking devices just outside of Earth's atmosphere, take me now. Doing Coast to Coast twice in one weekend, it's always fun. It's like heaven. So just take me on a high point, and I'm going to love tonight's show. I hope you do too. We were talking about it last night. If you missed last night on Coast to Coast, please go back. Really interesting opening lines, open lines, and I've got to get to a follow up on a question during open lines. But even before that, we talked to Marjorie Wildcraft and her terrific book about herbal remedies. And she had this book called Snake Bite, How I Successfully Treated a Venomous Snake Bite at Home, and the five essential preparations you need to have. Plus, if you go back and listen to it on Coast Insider, if you have that, stick around for all of the other things that are in this medicine bag that she's got. It's really cool. So enjoy, love that, love the open line calls. And then tonight, it's going to be Peter Lavenda. And we're going to talk about his research into sinister forces, the reality of these sinister forces in the world. And we'll get to that next hour. ML Berman has agreed to be on. Now, I did not know that last night, or I would have mentioned it. But it was actually because of a caller last night that I started poking around, and I came across ML Berman's YouTube page, and I saw that he'd posted a bunch of new videos since the last time we had him on. So he's got to tell those stories. And he will, coming up this hour. We'll still throw out the numbers at the bottom of the hour so you can join the conversation too. That having been said, the question that was posed last night was, what was Howard Bloom talking about during the debate with John Curtis on Thursday night's Coast to Coast with George Norrie? Because there was a story he never got back to, an ending. I just want you to know, I tried. I reached out through the producers to see if I could get the rest of that story. The question has been forwarded to George Norrie, and hopefully that'll get resolved coming up. But I couldn't resolve it tonight, unfortunately. But I'll give you something great in return. If you're watching the skies, you're going to love what ML Berman's been working on. Look for those dark shadows that float in front of the moon. And especially if you're in the desert, don't get out of your car. We'll explain why coming up next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. ML Berman is an author of both the fiction and nonfiction books. He wrote this really cool series about a character in the West that blends the paranormal and the idea of the cowboy motif. The J. Everett Earle series. But I fell in love with his YouTube work. And it was just a fluke, ML, that I was looking for something else. And I saw that you had been posting more videos this year. And I hadn't, the last time I checked, there hadn't been anything new up. And suddenly I saw, have you had three new YouTube videos this year? Is that what I'm seeing?
Actually, this year I think there's about 8.
Okay. Well, then, gosh darn it, you should text me or email me or something, because I would have had you back on in a heartbeat. You know how much I love your stuff.
Now that I know, thank you.
Well, I mean, I loved when you were on the a year and a half ago or so, and we talked about so many of the cool things you've been working on. I will say, is it just me, or when I looked at the new videos, you look just a little more silvery than in the... Am I right? Hair's looking just a little whiter. But you do them so well. These are great videos. So if you go to YouTube, look for Mojave Mysteries and ML Berman's work, Behrman. And I was so excited. I was watching them, and I was like, oh, this is great. And I called up the producers right away and said, can I have them back on? Can I? So thank you for agreeing at the last minute to come back on.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure.
Yeah, I think, when we first had you on, I hope you're still getting good momentum from all of the new clicks and the new fans that we brought to your page. What are your numbers like these days on YouTube?
Well, I'm still a little guy. I've got about 5,000 subscribers, very loyal subscribers that share all sorts of great stuff that I get to follow up on and have given me all sorts of info around some of the stories I've brought out.
Cool.
And then, yeah, I've got like 300,000 or more views just in the last little bit. So it's good.
Okay. What are your so what do we think your total views are? Because I don't know why Discovery Channel or History Channel or somebody hasn't picked up your work. And had you reshoot it, you know, have you become like a regular series provider for those networks?
Well, I have talked to a couple of them have reached out to me.
Good.
So, you know how it is. It's like talk, and you can't say anything, and we want to change everything. And so right now I haven't gone forth with anything.
Okay.
I've just been working along on my own because really that's, you know, where I have the most control is to do it how I want to do it.
And it's charming the way you do it. So it really is, because I always love that sort of campfire thing you've got going where I know – You're packed out into the desert. You've got, you know, you're talking to the camera. There's a little bit of a sort of a naked and afraid vibe, although you're totally clothed. But I just mean that in the sense that it's like you and the elements and the story you're going to tell. And so Mojave Mysteries, the book or the YouTube video series, you have to see it. But I was sort of captivated, too, by something that I always found interesting. Is the idea that there could be pterodactyls in the Mojave. And the reason why I say that is because I remember years ago somebody saying that whether it's thunderbirds or whether it, regardless, that one of the problems with looking at birds in wide open spaces like a desertscape is that when you look up, you have no other frame of reference for the size of the creature.
For scale.
And so they said, you know, we could have spent our whole life looking at things and not realizing, because it was up so high, just how big it was. And I thought that's always sort of caught me off guard a little bit when I look up and I see something that looks really big. So tell me about your pursuit of surviving flying dinosaurs.
Okay, well, as you know, part of my thing is I love to look at a story or a tale from a historical angle in addition to whatever the modern reports I get. Because I find often so much of the phenomenon has a backstory or a tale that goes back hundreds of years sometimes. And it's interesting to see how the phenomenon either changes or stays the same, which makes you tend to think you're actually dealing with something a lot more concrete than just folklore. Now, the flying dinosaur thing, now first I got to say this. In the episode, I pronounced it pterodactyl.
I saw you do that.
And I got skinned alive.
I know you did.
Like, no, stupid.
I wasn't going to bring it up. I swear to God, I wasn't going to.
It was pterodactyl.
Right.
It's like when I was.
Pterodactyl, I think. Yeah,
pterodactyl.
Right.
Correct. It was pterodactyl. Yeah. And then I had met a guy that was working on it. He goes, no, the modern pronunciations.
So, right.
Anyway, I know the difference. And so, to the point. Yeah, you mentioned the Thunderbird, which is a story of a huge flying bird that goes back to Native American history. Now, that is considered an actual bird. They never say it's a flying reptile. They say it's a feathered
bird,
an animal. But at the same time, there's been stories of what they would call flying dragons or a flying snake-like animal. And I went back and I looked at archives in the 1800s, and I found all sorts of stories that were people actually doing expeditions after these things and had sworn they had shot them and brought them down. I don't know if you saw the one thing about some lady claimed that one killed her cow in the field because it tried to swoop down and grab it and broke its back and it was too heavy to carry off, and that people from the British Museum came out and actually claimed that they had found a living one in a cave that they disturbed and it flew off. And right up till today, where I've had people tell me that they've seen something like that up near Death Valley and described it as you would describe a flying dinosaur. And what's interesting is some of them claim that it's a lot smaller than what you would mentally envision, you know, a pterodactyl being some 30-foot wingspan,
right,
like that.
Right.
They say it's a lot smaller, like 6 to 8 feet, and tends to hang near rivers. Now, pterodactyls, it's presumed that there were ones that flew over the ocean and picked birds, fish out of the water, just like fishing eagles do today.
Right.
And that they might be exhibiting some of that same behavior. The problem is when you're dealing with something 6 to 8 feet, it can get confused with a lot of other things. So you have to really look at the stories. Like one couple said that they had found tracks where it had landed, and it actually left tracks that looked like an alligator's track, you know, very reptilian,
right,
with three toes, claws, and like that. Now that, in addition to what they saw it on the ground, would seem to be something that's a little more unusual than if they just mistook an eagle, an owl, or something like that. Now, something interesting, when I shot that episode, I did the final summation, and I went out for a hike that evening just because I was out anyhow, and I'm walking along, and I see this huge shape come sailing along on the air overhead, and it turned its head, and it had this great long triangular head, just like
okay.
the classic comic book
right.
pterodactyl. And I literally went, no effing way, you know.
Right.
I just did this, and now I'm seeing it. And, of course, classic, I have no camera on me because I had finished shooting.
And you were just hiking, like, for fun.
And I'm like, okay. But what happened is it got overhead, and just at the last minute it turned, and I saw it was a ginormous pelican. Now, a pelican has the same profile as...
Right.
Yeah. And I watched it sail overhead and continue on into the basin and sail away. And I went, okay, well, that solves one mystery. But the second mystery is, what was a pelican doing out in the middle of the Mojave?
Yeah, a giant, you know, one, too.
Yeah, riding the thermals. Now, when right. I say giant, I mean, it had a 6-7 foot wingspan.
But that's a big bird. I mean, and
yeah,
I think
right,
that's really...
Right. And its head, it's, you know, they have such a huge
right.
head. And so I went home and I was researching, and I find that sometimes pelicans and seabirds would get caught in thermals on the coast and actually get swept over the desert in part.
Huh.
So that's what must have happened to this guy. He must have just been a lone voyager, and he
sure.
had along. As I was walking under him, and so anyway, it really brought home the idea, like, wow, you know, if I hadn't seen him turn at that last minute where I saw it was a pelican, I would have gone home and told someone, like, hey,
exactly.
I saw. Yeah,
right. If you had a camera, and you caught a silhouette or a slightly blurry image, everyone,
yeah.
I think we'd all see the same thing that you were seeing too.
Exactly. Now, when that story posted, I got some emails from a couple guys that said that they had seen it, and that one guy said his grandpa had caught one up in Death Valley, and they had kept it tied to a post and fed it, and it was the size of a large vulture. Now, of course, I'm like, okay, that's a great story, but if you've got it sitting there, then where are the pictures? Show me some videos. Show me some pictures. And it turned into one of those things. Well, they're coming. And I never saw. So
okay, right.
Yeah,
that'll happen. It's a pleasant surprise when somebody sends you a photo, and it, at very least they follow through, and it is something, even if it isn't what they thought it was originally.
Right.
Because
even if it's a blob, you
right.
know, a blob squatch, as they call us. Because
we went through that with the guy who, and you were helpful. Remember the person that found those little icons along
mm-hmm.
the side of the road,
mm-hmm.
sent
mm-hmm.
you the photos, and they turned out to be something that's explainable, but it was really cool for a while as you're wondering, like, what did we trip over? You know.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That was quite an epic little.
Yeah. Could have turned into something. So as you said, we're talking with ML Berman. His YouTube series is Mojave Mysteries, and he follows not just, you know, stories of cryptids, but all sorts of strange things that happen out in the Mojave. Just for people who can't quite picture it or don't want to, just too tired to get up and look it up. Explain the context of the Mojave. What kind of an area are we talking about?
Well, we're talking about a giant arid desert that covers most of Southern California, a bit of Arizona, a bit of Utah, and a bit of Nevada. And it encompasses everything from what you would imagine, Death Valley's there, a burning hot expanse, to mountains that are pine forest and stuff like that. So it has a wide range of territory, but the biggest thing is the desolation, the remoteness, the fact that the military sticks things out there that they don't want people to see because people don't go out there. I always say, there's two reasons people go into the desert mainly. It's either to get away from something they've done or to hide something they're going to do. And then there's guys like me that just love exploring in the desert, and it's the closest thing to the surface of the moon or Mars that you can get physically
That's about right.
to check out.
And it's the extremes of the Mojave too, where we are talking about Death Valley temperatures in the 120s, right? In the daytime, it can be
That's the air. The ground can be up to 150.
But at night, it can then plummet completely in the other direction.
Yeah, exactly. You can. People don't believe that you can freeze to death in the desert, but it's
In the
very
desert,
easy at night.
you can. And so it's those extreme temperature swings that kind of add to the lure of the place. It's sort of like, as you're saying, you're on one side of the moon, now you're on the dark side of the moon, all in, you never left the space you're in. So this is why originally, I mean, I sort of got fascinated with the idea of all of the crimes that people cover up by going to the Mojave or taking their victims to the Mojave, and the old mining wells that nobody has excavated. We have no idea what's at the bottom of those mining wells, but that becomes like a handy kind of disposal for a lot of illegal activity, plus people making meth in the desert and other things that were happening for a long time.
Right,
So
right. When you say the desert, people either think of Roswell, UFOs, or they think of Breaking Bad type thing, or they think of, devil cults and
right.
racing with the devil and those type old movies.
So the but yet they're also sort of even in the cryptid categories, you said there are these stories of these giant attacking killer eagles, these giant raptors.
We have all sorts of giant birds, huge hunting owls, eagles, golden eagles. We have condors, all sorts of large birds. And again, I did an episode on this. Giant bird attacks was in the early days, people would report that an eagle tried to snatch their kid or took their dog or attacked them when they were out riding their horse. And conventional animals, in that they're an eagle, but of an exceptional size. And what's interesting is one article, they had a guy went out to repair the telegraph wire, right? This is in 1890. And he was up on the pole, and a giant eagle attacked him. It was described as an eagle. It was a dark bird, brown feathers with a sharp beak. And it was attacking him, and he managed to knock it out with a hammer he had on him. He jumped down, took some telegraph wire, wrapped it up, and took it into town where they displayed it for all the townspeople. Now, there isn't a photo of that, but they have an illustration of it, and all these people that claimed they saw it. And then 30 years later, an eagle tried to take a child, and her dad shot it. And that is a photograph that exists, and it's a massive bird that they're holding up between them. And that's available on that episode if they watch it. I have the picture.
And that again brings us back to the potential of the confusion of a pterodactyl, should it have survived into modern times, even if there are none left today. If the reports were true, it's also possible, as you said, like a condor. How big is the wingspan of a condor? How long? How big can?
Understand the bigger ones can get up to almost 12 feet, which is...
Exactly.
Yeah.
So if you got a 12-foot condor, that's why some people could look up and mistakenly think, oh, well, look, that's a big condor, because that's what they're expecting in their mind's eye, not a pterodactyl.
Right, right.
So, so we have more, because there's some other new Mojave mysteries that ML Berman has posted on his YouTube page, and so we'll get to that. And then remember, our main guest coming up next hour, Peter Lavenda, is back. His Lovecraft trilogy fiction series is completed, but he wants to talk about the things that he's learned along the way in researching these novels, but also in his other books as well, and what he would argue to be the reality of sinister forces in our lives, whether we acknowledge them or not. That's coming up next hour. And I'm going to give you the number so that you can join the conversation with ML Berman coming up next, too, on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. So those are the numbers. And you are listening to a night when we're going to talk about some really fun kind of Halloweeny kind of stuff. But if you go online at coasttocoastam.com, you can find out more about the special Ghost to Ghost night coming up. Tom Danheiser was talking about it last night, too. They're going to curate ghost stories. And if you want yours to be included, then you got to email it in. You can find out more at the website. Also, we're having fun putting up these modified photos in a Halloween mode at coasttocoastam.com. So take a look at what's in your collection. Have some fun with those. Either one of those means it's going to be a special week coming up for Halloween. And there's plenty of time for you to get in on it at coasttocoastam.com. Getting some calls. And we'll join up with ML Berman. He's got some more stories to tell you about Mojave mysteries that he's uncovered since the last time he was on the air with us here on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. ML Berman's video series, Mojave Mysteries, is great. It's on YouTube. You can sign up. You can become a subscriber. He deserves it. Does beautiful work, very entertaining. And I was remiss in not keeping up to date until late last night, early today, and I was going through all the new ones, and I'm going, dang it, we got to get him back on again. So thank you, ML, for agreeing to come on at the last minute tonight. And the book as well, and your novel series, the J. Everett Earle novel series, is really cool too. But I will say I don't spend a lot of time in the Mojave, and I guess Kingman, Arizona is considered part of the Mojave.
Oh, yeah.
Right. So that part of Arizona is what is included. People tend to think of the Mojave as mostly, and it is mostly California, but it extends. And so I've stayed in Kingman a bunch of times. When I lived in Phoenix, I would often make the drive up to Vegas for one reason or another, usually for an academic conference once a year. And if I made the drive at the end of a long day, I would just stay the night in Kingman and then finish I would summit Las Vegas the next morning. And so I got to know Kingman a little bit. It's right there at the intersection of a lot of major highways, including the original Route 66. It's a historic town. It's got some really cool old buildings that go back to the, you know, sarsaparilla and a six-shooter. You know, and there was there's a strong mining history around that. But here's the part that I thought was a cool tie-in, is that when we think about UFO crashes in the desert, we think almost exclusively of Roswell, which is not Mojave. Or you get around Area 51 too, but right, there've been like five of them, if I remember the YouTube story from earlier today, been five UFO crashes reported in the Mojave?
Yeah, between 1949 and 1967.
And one of them happened near Kingman.
Yeah, in 1952, and it's got a real folklore around it because a lot of people claim that the actual recovered ship that they have at Area 51 came from Kingman, not from Roswell, and it was because it was intact, and there was even the whole story that they had an alien they had captured with it, or an EBE, as they called it in the reports, and that he helped them reverse engineer stuff. Now, a lot of the tales surrounding the alien were debunked, and I mean, they were just so ridiculous and fantastic that you just had to laugh at most of them. But what was fascinating about this report was all the little stories that came out afterwards. One guy, a desert rat, supposedly saw it come down and got there first and collected a whole bunch of debris that he had found along with the crash, which was a acorn-shaped vehicle, they claimed. And he had an old crate with him in his Jeep, so he filled it with stuff. And he had some Native American friends who the Native American friends were sheep herders, and they got onto the site first and called him. He got out there, and they all filled this box. And then he gave it to the Native Americans to go bury in the desert and hide because he figured that someone would be coming asking. And over the years, rumors have trickled out that the box is still out there, or that they did retrieve it, the Native Americans retrieved it, and they're hanging on to it for whatever reason. But the whole story went from a simple thing that there was an atomic test and a ship got caught in the blast and it came down near Kingman, and then we have this whole tapestry of tales of captured aliens, recovered stuff, and that's what actually went to Area 51. The thing is, in the Mojave, like I say, there's five or six of these stories, so, and it's all in that little time frame. So I don't know what if that was like the training period for alien pilots, and they just were like piling up in the Mojave during those two decades. But a lot of them share the same type thing. One I was just working on happened out at Edwards Air Force Base a year later, 1953. And down south of here, down near the border of California and Mexico, there was supposedly another one. But the one that had the most documentation that I could find was the Kingman crash of 52.
But there are other mystery airship stories, too. So we'll hang on to that.
There's a huge thing of aerial phenomena.
Yeah. Well, hang on. Let me grab, we got a couple of people west of the Rockies. Josh is in Tucson on Coast to Coast AM for ML Berman, Mojave Mysteries.
Josh. Hello, thanks for having me on. Just wanted to say I enjoy the topic. It is fascinating. And I was kind of curious about Mr. Berman's thoughts on Quetzalcoatl, whose name, of course, translates to the plumed serpent.
Right.
And, you know, the lore says that Quetzalcoatl was a tall guy with blue eyes, a multicolored beard that came from the desert southwest of, well, the present-day United States, went down and taught the Mayans astronomy, mathematics, and language. And I'm just kind of curious your thoughts on that lore.
On the Q, as they call them.
Kind of question about if you have any thoughts on the mystery behind the trapezoidal man, the petroglyph that you can find pretty much in any direction, 900 miles in any direction from Tucson.
Okay, well, you got two questions there, right?
Yeah.
Quetzalcoatl, I'm familiar with that. There's been several interpretations of that, everything from visitors from Atlantis that landed on the coast and moved inland and taught the Native Americans stuff to pre-Columbian European contacts. I've read everything from Egyptians, you know, the Lost Pharaohs expedition, to Vikings, to all sorts of European stuff. And there is a written documentation and a folklore of these giants. Sometimes they're giants, sometimes they're just white men that taught them stuff. You know, I have no insight other than what I've read in all these different interpretations. I'm always a little leery of stuff where it's like the white man taught the guy, the native tribes, how to do stuff, because their science was very advanced. Their mathematics were incredible. They didn't need, you know.
Right.
But it's interesting that legend seems to be repeated a lot in that area. So there might have been some sort of like I say, pre-Columbian contact. Now, you know, whether it was esoteric or just simple trading, I don't know.
You know, that the great white savior motif, I agree, is also obnoxious when it's used. If that's being used in this case, I'm not sure, because so often white is often meant to say glowing.
Quite true. Quite true.
Yeah. So whether that was purely like a white in terms of, you know, Western European or something like that, or Eastern European either for that matter, I don't know. All right. So then we have his other question, though, was about the pyramidal man. The trapezoidal man. Yeah. What do you know about that?
I have to confess, I know absolutely nothing about that.
I'm so kind of fascinated by it.
I wondered if he was referencing the giant glyphs near Blythe, California, which I did a story on about the giant bones and the whole folklore of giants in the desert. But I had not heard about some specific measurement thing, other than they thought that might be part of a processional route that mystics and other people used back up to 1,000 years ago.
I learned something all the time on Coast to Coast, and I've been hooked by that one, so I'll be finding out more. Let's do East of the Rockies. I believe it's Phaedron who's in Charlottesville. Is that right?
That's correct. Thank you, Ian, for taking my call. Hello, ML.
Hello.
The reason I called is because I have a mystery that I haven't been able to solve for over maybe 25 years. It was still when I was up in Manhattan. There was a picture that looked like a pterodactyl, and it was nailed with the spread wings open on a guy's barn somewhere in the Midwest. And they said they couldn't give a name to it. They weren't sure if it was Thunderbird or whatever. And it was, you know, on radio. And again, this was during the Art Bell years and also in other magazines. Now, it just so happened that Fate magazine, which was at that time in digest form, 5 inches by 7, had a photograph of it. And in there, and also from some of my students, they said, well, if you have a copy of it, you will not ever see the photograph again. And it appeared in a couple of other magazines as well. Well, I got the copy of Fate magazine, put it on my shelf, read it, put it on my shelf, and I guess about 6 months or a year later, I'm looking for it, and somehow, very, very mystically, it disappeared.
Or the magazine did?
No, not the magazine. Well, actually, it was the magazine. Yeah, not the photograph. I'm going back, like I said.
Right, sure.
But, the magazine with the photograph of this thing. And I remember it, I saw the photograph today, it was an old barn, and it was a pterodactyl-shaped figure, probably about 25 feet in wingspan, something like
that. All right, well, let's find out. So, ML, does that sound familiar?
Oh, yes. And let me ask you, the picture you saw, was it cowboys holding up the body? Was it Union soldiers, Civil War soldiers? Or was it hunters that looked like they had tacked it to the wall of a barn? Do you remember the photo?
Well, there was one man standing in front. It was not soldiers. It was not a group of people. It was nailed to the end of a barn. It's sort of like a trophy type of figure.
Right, right.
Are you familiar with the figure I'm talking about?
Yeah, that photo is a famous trope out here. Originally, it was called the Tombstone Pterodactyl, and it was supposedly discovered nailed to the wall of a saloon in Tombstone in the 1880s, and it showed cowboys holding this thing that they had shot just outside of town, and didn't know what it was, but it was a large, leathery, reptilian-type figure, and in the picture, it looks just like a pterodactyl. Then other versions popped up. The one you're talking about, like where it's nailed to the barn, I've seen that one, and then I've seen the Civil War soldiers one. And the thing is, most of them are considered, well, all of them are actually considered fakes. They were considered a joke thing, because in the 1800s, they used to put all sorts of wild stuff on the wall of saloons that they'd make, like the jackalope. They'd take a skeleton and add stuff to it, and all sorts of what I guess would be considered obscene and adult stuff they do too. But That is a famous story about, you know, the pterodactyl that was shot by either hunters, cowboys, or soldiers. And I've seen, like I say, probably five
different versions,
versions of that photo. The one that the oldest one I could find was the cowboy one, and that's pretty much been proven to be superimposed in over something else that they were holding up. So,
I'll let you do your research on that. And that brings us, I think we just still have time to get in another one of your Mojave mysteries. And again, I recommend that people please subscribe to ML Berman's page, the YouTube page, Mystery Airships, UFOs in the Old West. So this is a perfect transition into cowboys and aliens.
Yeah. Right, right. Going back to Native American times where they'd be talking about lights and weird things in the sky, and it continued on to the 1800s where people would be describing what would look like a Zeppelin with searchlights on it or other things that were just glowing lights that moved real fast. Some were heard with engine noise, some were not. And there was even stories just like today of crashes. And what's interesting is in the 1800s, the crash stories, I found one where they were supposedly from Mars, but they looked just like us and wore the same clothing. But most of them were that the story was these were crazy inventors or top secret scientists who were working on their designs they were going to sell to the military and were testing them at night out in the desert so no one would steal their design, and that's what these things were. But what's interesting, and I talked about this, the evolution of the phenomenon. At the time, we were working on, or the world was working on Zeppelins and lighter-than-air aircraft and electric lights and stuff like that. But these things all exhibited technology that was probably 50 to 100, in some cases 200 years in advance.
Yeah, really?
Was at the time. Now, fast forward today, where like the Navy's seeing these things off of San Diego that are
right.
showing attributes that are way beyond our stuff now. What's interesting about the phenomenon is it seems to manifest itself in ways that are just beyond our current technological grasp, but not so much that we can't understand what we're seeing.
That's a really good point.
And Arthur C. Clarke, the inventor, you know, wrote 2001, he invented the communication satellite. He said that alien technology will be so advanced to us that it'll appear as magic, not technology.
Hmm.
Now, what we're seeing, like I say, demonstrably through the last 200 years is something that is just in advance of what we're currently at. So it's almost like something's dangling something in front of us, you know,
right.
showing us what's possible or what we might be shooting for or somehow manifesting what we're at the moment dreaming about, but is within our grasp technologically to create within a generation, two generations, five generations. And the whole mystery airship thing follows that same pattern. You know, here's things that use electric lights. Before, they were really rigging electric lights on stuff. We're showing lighter-than-air propulsion systems or being able to levitate against gravity. And like I say, some were described as what would be like a metal Zeppelin, which, you know, how many times do we hear like a cigar-shaped UFO
sure.
today?
Right.
And, right. And then right down to just lights that whizzed around. And I'm doing a story on right now about a phenomenon that was associated with it right up today where people would see these lights would be following railroad tracks or roads or highways and that would crack people's windshields. And damage equipment and stuff, almost like a ball lightning has been reported
right.
to do. But in other cases, people would hear noises with it, mechanical noises and stuff like that. So the phenomenon is varied, but yet, on the other hand, it does show definite, repeatable attributes that are interesting how they have morphed from then till now. Now we call them UFOs, or I guess now they call them UAPs, or unidentified aerial phenomenon,
right.
as opposed to actual vehicles. But back then they were called airships because that was what they were familiar with.
Sure. Well, that we'll look forward to that new episode coming up on YouTube. Thank
right.
you for jumping in tonight. I look forward to getting caught up with all of your episodes. And just next time you've got something, email me, let me know. We'll get you on right away so people know about it too on Coast
Great.
To Coast.
Great. Thank you, Ian.
You know I love your stuff, man. I just think you should be international. You do such a great job with it. And he does it all himself. He's just a one-man band out there in the desert. I think you'll really enjoy them. And they're short, too, so they're easy to share. Find out more by linking up to him through coasttocoastam.com. Peter LaVenda is back. The sinister forces you suspect are real, he says. And we'll talk about it next on Coast to Coast AM. This is...